Hi, my name is Amy, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact any anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Michael C. and Sue, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and/or understanding. Kevin O. will read the preamble.
Hi, my name's Kevin. I'm an alcoholic. The AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Jared S. will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Jared. I'm an alcoholic. These are the steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Avi will read the traditions.
Hi, everyone. My name is Avi, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such or never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Katie.
I'm Katie. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Thea for asking me to speak. Thea and Liz were actually the two people who brought me to this meeting, and I felt, as soon as I came here for the first time, like that this was my home, and I really like to thank the both of them for bringing me here. I started drinking when I was 10 years old, and I don't remember exactly when, but I remember I would come home from school, and my parents had these little shrimp cocktail glasses, and they were so little, and they were so fancy, and they had white Zinfandel wine in a box in the refrigerator. And it was so pink, because it was cheap white Zinfandel. So I would come home from school, and I would get these little glasses of wine, and I would fill them up, and I'd watch Fraggle Rock, and I would drink the little glass of wine. And I just thought, if the kids at school could just see me now, because I felt so sophisticated and fancy with my little glass and my TV show, and I just thought it was nothing. And it progressed, as drinking does, and it was accepted in my family. Drinking, the kids drinking was accepted in my family. And I remember one night I was about 16 years old, and I had graduated from the little cocktail glasses to the, 36-ounce Taco Bell plastic cup that you get with the value meal. And I remember I drank the whole thing one night, and I threw up all over myself. And I was all alone watching TV, and I called for my dad to help me, and he came downstairs, and he's like, "It's okay, Kate, just don't drink as much next time, and you'll be fine." And I never listened to that, but I kept drinking through college, and I wasn't a daily drinker in college, but I would always look forward to the weekends and look forward to how, you know, where were we going. And I hated dancing and I hated nightclubs, but I loved drinking. So I knew that I always went to the dancing and I always went to nightclubs because I knew I'd be able to drink if I went there. And it took me 9 years to graduate college and get my bachelor's degree, but I finally did it. And then after college, I'm actually a singer, and I got a job with an opera company, and it was just my dream job, and it never happens that, you know, I just got so lucky I got this job right out of college. And I met some friends through the opera, and they took me drinking, and I found my my bar, and it was called The Spigot. And if we wanted to be fancy, we called it Le Spijo. And vous allez au Spijo? And we would go there. And I felt like, you know, when I came to this group for the hometown, it's like I found a home group with them. You know, I knew everybody there. And I did service there. And it was fabulous. I would get behind the counter and I would pour beers, and I just felt like I really belonged there. And, you know, I had made a host of fair weather friends around me, because anytime there was a problem, you know, my friends weren't there, but if I showed up at the bar, they all loved me, and they were all glad to see me. And I met somebody at Le Spijo and moved in with him. And really, you know, we drank together, and to me, it was the perfect relationship because it was just great. We never talked, and all we did was watch TV and drank together, and I see a pattern. And we would drink together, and we lived together for about 5 months, and then I got a call from my dad, and he said that your mother's very, very sick, and she's in the hospital, and you should go see her when you get a chance. And when you get a chance was 2 weeks later. I went to go see my mother in the hospital, and I wasn't quite sure what was wrong with her, but I found out that she'd had alcoholic pancreatitis. And her organs were failing. And, you know, I walked into the room, and I had no idea what to expect, but I wasn't expecting what happened. She was... so bloated, and she was yellow, and she had tubes everywhere, and they tied her to the bed because she was pulling the tubes out, and she just looked awful. It was a nightmare, you know? And she died after she was sick, really sick, for about 2 weeks, and then she passed away. We took her off life support. And, you know, a lot of people would, if that happened to them, if they saw their mother die like that, it scared me so much because I drank so much, and I knew that there's this propensity for people who have parents who are alcoholics to be alcoholics. And it scared me so much that it would keep me awake at night. And a lot of people, when they get that scared, they say, I'm not going to drink anymore. And what I said when I got that scared was, I need a drink. And, you know, I just, in one hand, I felt awful about what I was doing, but on the other hand, I really couldn't see my life without drinking. And I got to a really, really dark place. I went from being an opera singer to a truck driver to, thank you, to a bartender at the Red Lobster in Wethersfield, Connecticut. And, you know, one night, it was like the opposite of I Have Arrived, because I was at the bar, and somebody said, oh, I heard you're a singer, sing for us. And I would sing, and we pooled our tips so I would get better tips and for everybody. And I just thought, you know, what happened to me? What happened to me? I woke up one day in the bar at the Red Lobster, but that's really not what happened. It was this progression. And finally, I gave up. And I drank for a year and a half after my mother died. And one day, through a series of coincidences, I met up with a friend of mine who I went to college with. And she looked great. She looked fabulous. And I went out for this singing job, and I didn't get it. And she got my job, and I hated her, and I wanted to be her. So I said, what are you doing with yourself? Why do you look so good? Why do you sound so good? And she said, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life has never been better. And it really struck home with me, because when I went to college with her, she was a bigger mess than I was, and I was a big mess. And she, there was just something about her. And, you know, my brother had been in the program, and I was really reluctant to go. There's a part about contempt prior to investigation in the book, and that was me. I swore that I would never come here. And when I did come here, I immediately felt welcomed. And, for the first 10 minutes, I felt really uncomfortable. But then, at my first meeting, I just felt really loved and really cared for the first time in a long time. And it's been amazing ever since. I moved from Connecticut. My dad cut me off, and he wrote me this letter about how I was an embarrassment to the family, and how he really tried really hard to love me, but he couldn't bring himself to speak to me anymore. And it was like a 2-page long letter. And when I got sober, I started working the steps. I got a sponsor, and I started working them as they were outlined in the big book. And through the process of the third step was a very important step for me, and as well as the ninth step. When I first came in, I told my sponsor, I'm never doing the ninth step. And she said, okay, you're not allowed to talk about the ninth step again, because the steps come in an order. You're on step one. You have 8 more steps to go. So I finally started working the steps, and I got to my ninth step. And I went to, you know, beforehand, I met with my sponsor to tell him what I was going to say. And my sponsor said, have no expectations. And in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, my dad's either going to, you know, blow up at me, or it's going to be a Hallmark moment, and we're going to live happily ever after, and it's going to be great. So I went to my dad, and I did my amends to him, and I poured my heart out to him, and I stopped, and he looked at me. He was really quiet, and he said, accepted. And I was like, accepted? I just poured my heart out to him. I was like, all right, Dad, I'll see you later. And then 2 days later, he sent me an email, and it had all the reasons why he's so proud of me now. And I pay my bills, and I call him, and I don't ask him for money. And it was the complete antithesis of the letter I got. And I felt like that part of me had been healed, because I was so hurt by that letter. Even though it was, you know, basically it was of my own making, I felt like I really came full circle with it. And I'd never, ever would have been able to do that on my own. That was only through finding a higher power and learning, you know, humility, being able to say to someone, I was wrong and I apologize. And my sponsor always says, is it better to be right, or is it better to be happy? And I really have to, I still have to think about it, because in some instances, I think it's better to be happy. But I'm still learning, I'm still growing. And, you know, this was amazing, it was an amazing thing for me. And I have 1 minute left. I've got sponsees. Since I started sponsoring people, I've had about 9 sponsees. And the thing is, you can't give up. You have to keep trying. And I have 2 sponsees right now who are just helping me out so much. Every time I take them through the book, I learn a little bit more about the book. And also, you know, it really holds me to my word. If I tell them to pray in the morning, I have to pray in the morning. If I tell them they have to practice these principles, it means I have to practice these principles too. So thank you so much for listening.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Jim.
That's good. Thank you. Hi, my name is Jim Herron. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful to be sober. And I'm kind of amazed that I'm sober. I never, you know, for so many years, I just couldn't imagine how my life would come together. It seemed that it wasn't going to come together for so long, forever, you know. I'm a member of the Atlantic Group. My sponsor's Joel. My sobriety date is March 18th, 91, and I'm working the steps again with my sponsor, 9 through 12. I'll tell you a little bit about my background, my drinking background. I love drinking. I loved it when it was first handed to me. I couldn't wait. I drank as much as I could, as soon as I could. For as long as I could. And I had lots of, you know, unmanageable experiences early on and for years, and I really felt like that was part of the drinking life. I was ready to accept that. That was okay, you know. I knew older alcoholics, and I knew what, you know, maybe some of what they had to put up with, and I felt like, you know, that's part of the deal. At first it worked, you know. It was a release, it was license, it was, you know, a relief, it was fun. After a short amount of time, you know, by the time I was in my early 20s, I had totaled 4 cars. None of them were mine, so I had some explaining to do, and I totaled them, you know, badly. I had big car accidents, and I really felt like, oh, gosh, you know, that happened again, you know. Darn it, you know. And I felt like it wouldn't happen again. And I felt like it was wrong to drive drunk, you know. Like, that was wrong. I knew that, you know. But I wasn't drunk enough, you know, for that to happen. I blacked out a lot when I drove. I woke up at home, and I never expected to wake up at home with a car. You know, like, oh, my God, how did that get there? That happened a lot. I threw up while driving a lot. And there were lots of, you know, near crashes and, you know, crashes where I didn't total the car. There was a lot of that. And it wasn't all about cars, you know. If you took my driving behavior and applied it to, work, you know, that was my professional life. And if you took it and applied it to other people, that was my social life. You know, if you took and applied it to an apartment, that was my home life. You know, I've been in my apartment now for almost all of my sobriety, and for not quite 15 years. And it's the first apartment I've ever kept. I've had lots of apartments, and I always lost them. I lost every apartment, because every bit of money I ever made, I had to spend on alcohol. I made all my important financial decisions at 2 in the morning. And I just thought, it'll be okay. I'll figure it out tomorrow. And I would figure it out tomorrow. And, you know, I'd get the money somehow, and I'd spend that. And then I'd steal the money, and I'd spend that. And then I'd, you know, promise, and then I'd spend that. And then I'd leave. I'd leave the apartment. I just wouldn't. I would stop going there. That's how I moved out of apartments. I never, ever, to this day, have have gotten a truck and gone and gotten my stuff and taken it somewhere else. I've just left it all there, always. And, you know, I don't know. That was okay. I mean, that's not why I got sober. I had this fantasy. It occurred to me one time that, like, Intergroup down on 27th and 8th has this, like, apartment hunting service for people who need to have a place to have their bottom. And I got those apartments, you know. My last apartments were, like, rented rooms with, like, bathroom down the hall, broken windows, you know, bottles everywhere, you know, and I lost those places, you know. They were horrible, you know. Anyway, you know, I got worse. I got lonelier. My drinking got more isolated. I had to lie to more people to keep drinking. I had to be more private in my drinking, which was hard, you know, crashing cars and disappearing for long periods of time. I'd drink for days, you know, on end, and, you know, I didn't sleep. I was, you know, 20 pounds lighter than I am now, and, you know, by the time I finished, I was, thank you, I was, you know, often covered with, you know, or not covered, but bruised, and, you know, occasional black eye, fat lip, you know, always had a marvelous story about how these things occurred, which was, you know, which sounded to me, you know, believable, or at least, you know, to make you go awayable. And, you know, whenever I hear someone share, I feel like, whenever I hear someone qualify, I feel like someone gets to the point with all the unmanageable drinking where they get to a point, you know, it's unmanageable like 10 years before, you know, and then it got bad. And that's the way I feel about mine. And then, you know, you hear the person come to a place where they were just totally in despair, you know, where they thought, like, you know, it's just totally in despair. And that's what I felt, too. You know, I had, you know, I tried to stop drinking. I didn't think it was my problem, you know. I did an outpatient clinic. I did therapy. I walked myself through the park at night and said, you know, you have got to stop this. You have got to stop. And sometimes I'd be drunk within a couple hours, you know, over and over and over again, you know. I thought my problems were too big and they went too deep into me and into my past for any of this to work for me. It just didn't seem sufficient, you know. I just didn't think it could work, you know. And because of that, and because, you know, I was so confident, given, you know, my track record, that I really felt like, you know, I should keep running the show. I really held on to it, you know, to the bitter end. So when I went to meetings, you know, of course, I sat in the back and I tried to critique what was said. I tried to get the gist of what was going on and get the moral, you know, and that should be enough. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, got it, I'm out, you know. And I felt like over and over again, I clearly didn't want to drink. I felt genuine, heartfelt gratitude that I didn't have to live like that anymore, and I kept drinking over and over again. Anyway, I'm going to speed it up now. I did 4 treatment centers, and I did 9 months in a halfway house, and I kept drinking, you know, and I would, you know, and I felt like it'd be crazy to drink. I put on 20 pounds and I've gotten all this sleep, you know, who would do that, you know? Well, I would, you know, and there were a lot of things which caused a lot of pain in my life, you know, and I thought if I dealt with them, I would be able to stop drinking, and so I tried to deal with them, and I couldn't stop drinking. Eventually, and people tried to help, you know, people did try to help. Eventually, a person who I was genuinely afraid of, who had done a significant amount of prison time, who looked like he had done a significant amount of prison time, who, you know, who looked like a scary guy, who had been sober for years, got right in my face, you know, a couple of inches away, and said, "What are you willing to do for your sobriety?" And totally put me on the spot. And it's a question that I really needed to be asked, and I needed to be put on the spot for it. And I, you know, and by the way, I would say I had earlier ended up on my knees, you know, which is where I never wanted to be. You know, I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe in spirituality. I didn't want any part of that. I ended up on my knees. You know, God, please let me stop doing this. But I couldn't stop doing it, you know. But he said, what are you willing to do for your sobriety? And I told him anything, which was a good answer because, thank you. I kind of made a commitment then, you know, to do what was to do what he told me and to do what was called for. I got a sponsor. The sponsor I got was very invasive, you know, had lots of suggestions that didn't seem to be just related to the steps, you know. And I thought, like, where is this guy coming from? Does he know who I am? And he's not that smart, you know. And, you know, I threatened not to take his advice, and I pointed out how he was, you know, wrong, and how he didn't get it, and how he didn't understand. He didn't understand me personally. And then I did what he told me. And it worked, you know, and it worked. Although it was some fun to threaten not to take it, not to take the advice. I got to say, you know, especially for people who are new or counting days or anything like that, I got to say, early sobriety, I felt like, for a long time, I felt like anxious and fearful, and I couldn't imagine that this would work for me. And I just want to tell you, you know, it worked. It really worked. And with that, thank you for letting me share.
Our main speaker tonight is Julia.
Thanks. My name's Julia. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, I'm so nervous, you guys. I got a text message from somebody that I'm sponsoring a couple days ago that said, the ego is not your amigo. And I have to say, so true. It's really a privilege to be asked to speak at this group. I have the deepest admiration for how this group is run, what you guys are about. Every time I come here, I'm more and more impressed. I hope to be able to become a member of the Atlantic Group at some point. I have a son who's almost 7, and when he's, you know, a little bit more independent, I'll be able to come out at night more and really make a commitment to being here. I think it's, you know, I mean, we each have to make our home group the best group, you know, and my home group is a fantastic group. My home group is NYU. And we're expanding. A lot of people are getting sober there. A lot of people are staying sober. So I don't want to say this is the best group, but this is a great group. So it's really an honor to be asked to speak here. And I am nervous. So I'm an alcoholic, big-time alcoholic. I first picked up a drink when I was 11. The first time I experienced alcohol, I loved it. I couldn't stop. I was a little kid, basically, and it was a party. The grown-ups wanted us to dance. We were too shy. They said, we'll buy you platform shoes. This was 1971, and I was still too shy, and so they started pouring these martinis, and it was a beautiful summer evening in East Hampton. And the, you know, shaker that these martinis were in was silver and cold, you know, and the water was condensing on the outside of it. And I can still see it. I mean, I can see the lawn, you know, I can see the sort of bay windows leading out to the lawn and the grown-ups. And, you know, they gave us these martinis, and it was like magic, you know, silver magic. And I could dance. And, you know, the girl's father promised us these shoes, and we danced and danced and had a great time, and the grown-ups left, and I kept drinking. And it was a crazy night, absolutely crazy night. I mean, I have these, you know, memories. The cat brought in a rabbit, dead rabbit. We all cried for the rabbit. You know, the Colombian housekeeper was chasing around my friend's little brother. You know, we were wild, right? And it ended up with me on the floor of this bathroom. And I'll never forget that either. You know, the cool white tiles. We were in the country, but it was a very New York bathroom. It was like black and white checkerboard tiles. And, you know, the room was spinning, and I was clutching the toilet and throwing up. And I thought it was great. The next morning, I went to the candy kitchen in Bridgehampton, you know, and had a coffee, and I really felt like, you know, I've arrived at 11. And, you know, so I was just, like, set up from the beginning. And, you know, there were some more nights like that. I remember I sprained my tongue once from kissing a boy when I was really drunk. I mean, you know, weird. And, you know, like, falling into the swimming pool, like somebody walking me around the swimming pool to try to sober me up. And, you know, every time I got to the 8 feet mark on falling in, you know, just to be sort of annoying. And, you know, I had it. I mean, I had the thing from the beginning, and I just loved what alcohol did for me, you know, from the get-go. And, you know, that was 1971 when I was 11. And, you know, they told me in the hospital where I ended up when I was 25 that it's a progressive illness and that it's fatal. And that was true in my case. It was not fatal. It was nearly fatal. And it progressed, you know, and it progressed through the 70s. And by the time I was 22, I guess I was drinking against my will. At that point, I had the first, I'd already been married. I mean, I had a very checkered adolescence. You know, and I want to say that, you know, I want to qualify a little bit as an alcoholic, but for me, this is not the interesting part of the story. So I really want to fast forward and get to sobriety because that's, you know, really where it's at. But, you know, just to give you guys a little more of an idea, I was, I'd already been married. I mean, I'd had a crazy time already, very crazy time, very dangerous time. You know, and I also want to say that I started out, you know, I grew up very near this church. And I just need to say that I was given everything that money could buy as a kid. You know, the best schools, you know, horses, you know, the whole thing. I mean, I was really well taken care of on the material level, and emotionally too. I mean, I was loved, and I knew I was loved. But, you know, my genetic background and my emotional background, my role model background, was alcoholism, you know, was really big-time alcoholism. You know, they say, what's the difference between madness and eccentricity? You know, $1 million, right? So, you know, my father was, like, pretty whacked, you know, but because he did it with a lot of style, you know, and a lot of charisma, you know, he was eccentric. You know, but, I mean, I went to see him, it turned out to be his deathbed, and he told me, you know, the story of the Baltimore special, right? He'd invented a drink that had rum and, you know, milk and all sorts of stuff, and it's the drink that your bartender knows to give you in the morning, right? And he knows to serve it with a towel because you're going to need to put this towel behind your neck and clasp one corner of the towel between your hand and the glass and pulley the glass up to your lips because, you know, your hands are shaking so bad you can't get the thing to your lips, you know. And, I mean, looking back, once I got to AA, I thought, oh, hello, you know, definitely an alcoholic. You know, but he was manic depressive, and, you know, all of this mania was completely dressed up as eccentricity and character and style, you know. So, anyway, I had already a very crazy time, and which had taken me very far from my roots and my upbringing into some very dangerous, you know, dreadfully dangerous situations as a young, you know, as a teenager. I was very lost, and I'd already been married, and by the time I was 22, I remember I had this boyfriend, you know, who I really loved and who really loved me and who was older. And he didn't want to go to the Mud Club and Danceteria. He was a painter, you know, he wanted to stay home. But, you know, he'd have a few drinks with me, you know, and then I'd go out. And I remember I'd go and I'd hear the band, you know, and then maybe I'd go to another club and I'd have said I would, you know, come home at midnight and I'd call and I'd say, I'm leaving now. And, you know, then I'd, like, have another drink, and I'd wait a little while, and then it would be 12:45, and I'd think, I gotta go. You know, so I'd call, I'm leaving now, I'll see you in 10 minutes. And then it'd be 1:45, and it was too late to call. You know, and that bar would close, and then there'd be an after-hours club, and then, you know, I'd be up, you know, everyone would be going to work, I'd have the sunglasses on, I'd be, like, gnashing my teeth, you know, rehearsing what I was going to say, and it was horrible, you know, and I'd get home, and he would be hurt and disappointed, you know, and annoyed, and, you know, I'd sort of pass out, I'd finally get to sleep, and then, you know, wake up and apologize and you know, win him back, and I'll never do it again. And I would mean it, you know, because it was awful, and I would really feel bad. And then by two nights later, you know, it was just like it never happened. Oh, look, Echo and the Bunnymen are playing. Or, oh, look, you know, Kid Creole is playing, you know. And I'd say, oh, you know, look, there's two sets. I'll go to the early set, and I'll see you at 11, you know. And I meant it. Do you know what I mean? I meant it. And I couldn't. I could not come home. You know, I just could not come home. And that went on all that summer. And I was, you know, 22, I guess, at that point. And I left him for somebody who was younger and wilder, who would come out. And, you know, it only took me about 2 years to end up in the hospital. They say, you know, we tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I didn't realize for a while that what happened is that moment, the turning point that each one of us has in our stories, where something miraculous happens. And instead of taking that next drink and just continuing on this downward spiral that basically no human power can stop, not ourselves, not anyone else, right? We're set up, we're going over the edge, we're going down. Something happens in each one of our stories. And it took me years to realize what that was in mine. And what it was that I had a car, talk about unmanageability, that had no starter, right? So I used to pop start the car in the city. Can you imagine? It's tricky to do that. Let me tell you, you have to run, you know, and drop the thing into first gear. So this is how I was living. And, you know, and it had no fuses. So, you know, I'd have to, like, work the windshield wipers by hand. I mean, it was so unmanageable. But anyway, and I was so deluded that I got in the habit of parking this car running on East 3rd Street. And East 3rd Street is the Hell's Angels block. Right? So guess what? Nobody touched my car, you know, because the Angels were across the street. But of course, I didn't notice that the Angels were across the street. I just thought it was my, you know, immense privilege and good fortune, you know, to be protected from all bad consequences. So one day I parked the car on the west side and the car got stolen. What a shocker, right? It's like a BMW sitting there running for, you know, 5 hours, right? So anyway, I had this moment of clarity where I was alone. I was almost never alone. And I realized that things were out of control and that I was in big trouble. I called the police to report the car. And they said, you have to come into the station. And there was no way I was going into any police stations. I mean, it was like, you know, the vampire entering the church. It was not going to happen. So, you know, I wouldn't do that. So I sat there and I kind of got it that things were a little out of control. And I made a tape recording. And I spoke out loud, basically to the air in the room, and I said, I'm in trouble. My friends aren't really my friends. I can't stop living this way. I'm really scared. You know, things are out of control. I don't know what I'm doing. You know, at that point, I had, like, nowhere to live. I mean, I was at my mother's, but, you know, it was not good. And I believe that that act of honesty, as best as I could muster it, was a prayer. Count it as a prayer. And that was the karmic transition that led to my getting sober. I asked the universe for help. I admitted that I was out of control. So shortly thereafter, my mother found me passed out and talked to some of her friends, and I ended up in the hospital. And I got to the hospital, and I was so sick. I must have weighed, I think I weighed about 50 pounds or 40 pounds less than what I weigh now. I was living on alcohol, never ate food. I was a breatharian, kind of. Well, I was an alcoholic. I was living on booze, you know, and I was staying up, you know, for days at a time, and I was like a vampire, and I looked like a cancer patient. I was so close to death from this disease, and I had no idea. I could get into Danceteria. They knew me at the door, you know, over at, you know, the Limelight, you know, the Mike Todd room. And I was like a shell of a human being, you guys. I had no soul anymore. I was so lost. You know, in the rehab, they said to me, who are you? And you know what? It was a really mean question. Because, you know, I really did not know. And I said, I'm a child of the 20th century. I just want to tell you how lost I was, you know. I was lost. So I got to AA, And, you know, it was amazing because my obsession to drink was lifted from me, which was a miracle. A miracle occurred when I got into the orbit around this massive sun of Alcoholics Anonymous. The obsession was lifted. I was saved from death. I had a pink cloud. I thought I was fabulous. Then I got fat. Then I hated myself. And sort of wooden share and, you know, fabulous downtown meetings. And I got fat and my leather pants wouldn't fit anymore. And, you know, I got very, very self-obsessed in a negative way. And I ended up picking up and by some grace, I got back. And about 9 months after that, I got my first real sponsor. And she only had about... only about a year and 9 months at that time, and I had about 9 months. And that was Kennedy F., and she was at the time being sponsored by Lorna. I'm sure you guys know Lorna, or some of you do. Lorna! And so Lorna was my grand sponsor, and she, Kennedy, just fed me everything that Lorna was teaching her. So she told me that it was very important to do service in the group. It was very important to, you know, do service because in doing service, I would know the other people who were doing service. I would be asked to speak. She had this English accent, and she would say, "Draw your chair close to the hearth of AA," you know, meaning sit in the front, you know, which I kind of knew from rock shows. The front is good. You know, but to apply it here, you know, to not be skulking in the back. And she insisted that I share, even though I was horrified to share. And she said to me, I remember one day she said, you know, everything that happens in your life is just what happens on the way to the meeting on a given day. It's all just what happens, thank you, on the way to the meeting. And I did not understand that. There were huge dramas going on in my life. But you know what? She was right. Because all those dramas have come and gone, and who remembers them? But I remember that on Thursday night, I went to Second Avenue. You know, on Friday night, I went to Soho. On Saturday, I went to Completely Sober. On Sunday, I went to the Soho Step meeting. I could tell you exactly what meetings I went to, and I still know a lot of people from those days. Put the compass heading on sobriety, and everything else just comes and goes. And it was true. It was really true. And, you know, she taught me how to eat and how to sleep and all that stuff. And we had, I stayed sober. I did service, got sponsees, talked to her. We had a falling out over something, and she declined to sponsor me anymore. And then I was sponsorless for about a year and a half. And then I got another sponsor, and I did some amends. I got up to the ninth step, and I did some amends. And, you know, I only connected this recently, but I started to feel better, maybe because of doing those amends. I never connected it until much more, you know, recently. But something changed anyway. And for the first time in my life, I felt all right. And I must have been 31 at that point. And I totally took my will back, is what happened. I always went to meetings, and I hung out mostly with people in the fellowship. I'm a bass player, so I'm not doing so much of that now, a little bit. But I was playing in bands, and most of the people I was playing with were sober. And I had a little bit of success. You know, we toured and stuff, had a lot of fun. And, you know, I was chain-smoking Marlboro Reds, right? I was, you know, wearing mini skirts and boots, you know. And now I'm sober, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. Right, and the Marlboro smoke is flying, you know, and, you know, I'm driving around and, you know, the country and playing, and, you know, I figured out how to have boyfriends rather than obsessions, and I finished school, you know, I did get my degree in sobriety, you know, and so some stuff was good, you know, and I could definitely have told you that, you know, things were a lot better, but I was whacked. I was so dry. I was so untreated. You know, at a certain point, I hadn't worked a step in years, you know, and I'd call my sponsor, like, you know, quarterly and, you know, to, like, tell her about some drama. And then, you know, I'd be embarrassed because I'd already told her about that drama. You know what I mean? So then I would stop telling her. And it was awful. And I fell in love with somebody who is 10.5 years younger than I am, who was an active alcoholic. Can you imagine after, you know, how many years of AA? You know what I mean? How many years of AA? How many stories of us being horrible to the people that we love and that love us? Did any of that occur to me when I kissed him? No. And, you know, by this point, you know, I'm 38, right? And I get pregnant, you know? And I was like, oh, I always wanted to have a kid, you know, I knew I would get around to it, you know, like having no idea that I was like, really, you know, and also having no interest in having a husband, right? Which, you know, I wouldn't mind now, I'll tell you. But, you know, maybe, I don't know, you get what you wish for. No, I mean, I never saw the point of a husband, you know what I mean? And so now I'm pregnant, and this beautiful, you know, boy, right, is bottoming out. And he is not ready to have a kid. I'm ready. I'm dry, I'm untreated, but I'm 38. You know, I've been sober for 12 years or whatever it was, you know. He is not ready to have a kid. And let me tell you, it really pushed his buttons. And he really, really took it out on me. And I really got what was coming to me. I got like a full-blown dose of, you know, and the negativity and the self-hatred that we all have projected onto, you know, someone else. It was me. It was, I don't recommend it, you know. I really do not recommend it. So we stayed together co-parenting, but we stopped being together. And about when my son was about 2 years old, I reached this bottom. And it was really, I don't know, you'd think I would have reached it by now, but, and it was like very quiet, you know, I just ran out of ground. And it was sort of like I'd done everything that I thought I wanted to do, you know. You know, I'd sort of had the little bit of rock and roll glory, you know, I'd gotten the degree, I had, you know, smoked all the cigarettes, I'd had the fantastic sexual relationship, and, you know, it was, my soul was bereft, I was empty, I was like pithed. And I started saying the 7-step prayer, which I had learned in early sobriety. And for the first time in my sobriety, I said that prayer with all of my heart. I said, you know, God, I'm now ready that you have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. And I really meant it. And I said this prayer. And you know, it was fantastic what happened. You know, I ended up back in the fellowship. I knew I had a big 4th step to write, but I couldn't write it. I just couldn't write it. Turned out I didn't really have 1, 2, and 3 at that point, but I had the enormous good fortune to be sort of re-sponsored at that time by Kevin H., who I think you guys know. He comes here a lot, I know, and speaks here sometimes. So the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, the solution that's laid out very clearly in the big book, the clarity in the big book about what alcoholism is, transmitted through him as an alcoholic who's had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, who knew what was wrong with me and what I needed to do, saved my life. My inner life is completely transformed due to what he gave me. And, you know, thank God, you know, he's a really talented guy. He's got a career. You know, he writes. He's written novels also, you know. And thank God that that particular person was not, you know, on a book tour or, you know, like too busy to take another sponsee. You know what I mean? Or like doing something else with his life. Because what he gave me was the most valuable gift I've ever been given, which was, you know, the spiritual solution. And, you know, I never really understood my alcoholism, that, you know, I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows today. The first step is today, not, you know, 19 and a half years ago, the last time I was drunk. It's today. I've got a mental illness. That's part of the powerlessness thing. So I can't recall my experience with sufficient force to run my life reliably. I have got to find another guidance system that I can sign on to with that will do that with me, that will do that. I cannot rely on my ego. My ego is not my amigo. So, you know, in really surrendering and knowing what my alcoholism is, you know, that second of the pertinent ideas, you know, that probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. So I got it, that there's some power here in AA. There's some power in the universe. There's some power that's always accessible. And so I had step two. Then, you know, it was easy to opt for that rather than what I had going on at that point. And in step three in the book, you know, I was really convinced and I really understood that self, you know, is really the problem. That whenever I've got a struggle, you know, with somebody else, you know, it's always the ego. It's always those aspects of self that are causing me to suffer. And in taking that third step, I made a decision to not buy into self as a way of life. And, you know, step three, it's like a deal, you know. It's kind of like the opposite of the deal with the devil. It's a deal with this redemptive force that, you know, if I let you run through my soul, if I let you, this redemptive consciousness, run the show, then basically I'm going to know what to do. I'm going to be safe. I'm going to be able to proceed based on that energy. But in exchange for that, I got to give up maintaining, you know, and fighting for and enforcing, you know, my will and my ideas. I've got to continually surrender absolutely. And, you know, I got it, and I was able to, you know, accept that from him. You know, I did a fourth and a fifth step, and I remember during the fifth step, he, you know, we were looking at the four columns, and he, you know, he covered the fourth column, one of my resentments, and he said, you know, how would you feel if you didn't have any of this, these aspects of self, if you didn't have any pride, you know, if you didn't have any self-centeredness, if you didn't have any fear, if there was no dishonesty or anger, you know, about this person, thank you, what would you feel? And, you know, I had to think for a minute, and I thought, well, I'd just feel love, wouldn't I? I'd just feel compassion. You know, there wouldn't be any problem. So he said that, you know, people really do hurt us, and the what they do to us is like an arrow that really does hit us, you know, in our physical or psychological body, and where it hits me, where that, you know, misconduct on your part hits me, affects me, you know, my self-esteem, my sexual relations, my security ambitions, you know, whatever. The barb that keeps that arrow in my flesh is self, is ego. If I don't have that, that arrow just falls out of me. Sure, it hurt, ouch, but you know what? It's gone, isn't it? I don't carry it around with me. The suffering is of my own making. So it was an incredible thing, you know, and I was really ready for this idea. So, you know, the house cleaning steps, you know, I really threw myself into those. And, you know, the 11th step, I had a sponsor after Kevin, you know, who said we're like toasters, devices that need to be plugged into the wall in order to work. If the problem is powerlessness, then I gotta have power. So once I've done those steps and I'm clear enough to, you know, have more conscious contact, then I've got to do that. I've got to get that on a daily basis. And I think, you know, in a way, all the steps are 11. Basically, all of the steps are bringing me to that point where I can, you know, have that contact with that, with this force. Even 12 is that. I mean, it says, we're told very clearly that the way for us to maintain our sobriety and to, you know, feel better when we're upset is work with another. You know, so it's all about 11, and it's all about what that enables me to do in 12. It's been, you know, it's been a really amazing year for me. I feel like, you know, 3 years ago, you know, basically my sponsorship with Kevin ended, and I've had three sponsors since. I realize that all sponsors in AA are either Bills or Bobs. And I had a couple of great sponsors, and then one of them was great, but she was a Bob. You know what I mean? She was like walking the walk, and she was a really steady Freddy, and her sobriety was great, but there just wasn't the pizzazz that I needed. You know, I realized I needed a Bill. You know, so I found Ava, who's a great combination of Bill and Bob. And, you know, this last year has been about really applying this stuff. And, you know, so many areas of my life have been, you know, enormously improved. You know, it's like the spiritual awakening, the rocketed to the fourth dimension and all that. But then it's implementation. You know, it's the transformation in our lives. So I'm sure I'm almost out of time, but just quickly, I just have to say very quickly that my mother, whom I haven't mentioned yet, was my big nemesis. Ever since I was 12, she and I were like enemies, you know, enemies. And I've had a terrible time with her in the sense of my experience of myself. My experience when I've been around my mother in the past has been just almost intolerable to me, intolerable. And, meanwhile, I'm sharing a house with her in Long Island for the summers, and she's old, and she's sick, and she has no man, and I'm the only child, and, you know, it's my job to deal with this, right? Plus, it's a great house, right? Sorry, I had to say that. So, you know, I wrote a lot of inventory. Let's put it that way. Once I got these tools, I wrote endless inventory about my mother, which really helped me. But the negative experience kept coming up. And I made amends to her a year and a half ago over the summer. And, you know, it was a fantastic experience. And I remember, you know, Kevin said to me, what are you going to wear? And I thought he was being sassy, you know what I mean? Like, what do you mean, what am I going to wear? Jeans and a T-shirt, you know, it's the summer in the country. And he said, no, what are you going to wear? You got to dress up for this. You know, this is one of the most important days of your life, you know? And I did. And it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. And I never thought I'd be able to do it, but I got tons of help from you guys, and I did it. And the relationship was still tricky, but then last summer, I got it. I somehow got just say yes. You know, she wants handrails. She wants the whole proof, the whole house, like, you know, sort of adult, you know, geriatric proofed. You know, yes. Where do you want the railings? What kind of railings do you want? You want me to go to the lumberyard? Yes. You know, I was all about no with her. And I don't know what happened, but our relationship transformed, which is a bigger miracle almost than, you know, quitting drinking. So, you know, I'm looking forward, if I continue to live, you know, to staying alive, to staying sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think the sky's the limit for us if we have these tools and the solution. So I'm very grateful to you guys. Thank you.